Good evening and a very warm welcome to the Oxford Martin School. I'm Ian Golden, the former director of the school, and it's a huge pleasure to introduce this evening Professor Robin Cohen. Robin's a very good old friend. I first met him when I was doing my doctorate in Oxford, and he was professor of sociology at Warwick. He's been a professor in many, many universities in the West Indies, in Nigeria, in South Africa, and here in Oxford, where he was professor in the International Development Department and was the director of the International Migration Institute, which was one of the groups that the Oxford Martin School founded to work on migration. He's someone who I've always thought of as one of the wisest, clearest thinkers on migration, and who's been able to combine a passion for the subject with extremely deep analytical rigor and policy coherence, and has always approached it in a different way to many others, with a real feel for the people involved, and has introduced into the literature many vital dimensions, not least related to diaspora and diversity. So it's with huge pleasure that we launch in Oxford this evening his new book, Migration. And it's an incredibly well-produced book. Robin is going to be selling it afterward at the giveaway price of £10, because it actually says £20 on the back. And I think it must have cost about £30 a copy to produce, because it's so full of colorful illustrations and is really a very, very beautifully produced book. But it is the best summary I've seen of the various strands of what's significant in migration, and I can think of no better way of thinking and seeing oneself into this extremely complex and increasingly vital subject. So, Robin, it's with huge pleasure that I ask you to introduce us to the book.
Well, thank you very much, and I particularly wanted to thank Ian, not only for his generous remarks, but of course the fact that he helped to launch the International Migration Institute, which now has found a new home at the University of Amsterdam. And we were a very friendly school in the Oxford Martin School, a very great launch to a brilliant idea, and Ian has been a very distinguished director of it. Okay, so this is a book called, the title of which is rather sort of grand, and of course publishers being what they are, they want the bigger, the better, the wilder, so you can imagine it's not completely simple to say the movement of humankind from prehistory to the present and squeeze everything in of significance. And in fact, the way the book is set out is that there are 44 chapters. There is some guiding principle to this, these chapters. What shall we say? It's less than comprehensive and more than random, probably is the easiest way to explain it. But we won't be able to go through these chapters in any great detail this evening. So I'm going to pick out three themes. The first theme, which is also the title of the first chapter, Out of Africa, when migration, human migration began. The second, looking at Irish emigration, I think it's sort of middle period of the historical period that I'm covering. And then the final period, which combines two themes, looking at the growth of migration, and in particular the mass displacement of refugees and other survival migrants, and how, if any way, the attempt to try and wall people off is working or not working. There'll also be time for question and answer a little later on. And I'll take the opportunity to read very briefly from each of those three themes, something in the book. So the first theme then, out of Africa. And of course, migration scholars have to learn new skills. In the old days, It was artifacts, it was linguistic traces, it was fossil remains. Now it's DNA. And we have a DNA map there tracing human migration. I'll show you another one a little later on. First out of Africa, and then the yellow banding Erectus and the orange banding Neanderthal. And of course, there's been a lot of stuff in the newspapers, and every now and again, there's a new discovery, a new fossil, a new bit. And that seems to throw people off and say suddenly, oh, they wouldn't come from Africa. Some of them came from Europe. This is not the case. Human migration started in Africa. Neanderthals also started in Africa, although at a different time. But a couple of years ago, there was a lot of publicity around the meeting of Neanderthals and Homo sapiens in the southwest of Europe, that about 2% of the genome of humans are now seem to have Neanderthal. So that's very interesting because it implies that humans were not quite so smart, didn't outwit Neanderthals as had subsequently, as had previously been thought. We also had just last month the discovery, or the new discovery of, oh, human beings started in Botswana or Namibia, it was the year before. And of course it is the case that there are, if you like, in Africa, two zones that are very important. One is South Africa or Southern Africa, going up towards the Namibian border, and that's the cradle of humankind. And if you want to express it in a slightly different way, East Africa, the Rift Valley, can be easily represented as the nursery of humankind, so a little later on. Well, I wanted to focus on this slide, because in this book, I have a discussion, I say, thinking upside down, and it's a counterfactual. And you probably know that historians and others are rather not very keen on counterfactuals. I say, please don't use counterfactuals. Actually, I like counterfactuals, because counterfactuals are what would have happened if. And they say, oh no, look, deal with reality, deal with how it was. Don't deal counterfactual. But all the good questions are based on counterfactuals. And the counterfactual in this case is, what would have happened if we hadn't had urban civilizations? What if we had remained rather like the people in that slide? So I'm going to read just a short passage. We often imagine civilization as the triumph of the sedentary over the mobile. But human settlements have created enormous problems. With humans bumped up against each other, diseases spread, while many city planners have struggled to provide adequate food, housing, transport, security, education, potable water and sewage. To feed urban populaces, the countryside has been blighted by commercial agriculture, pesticides, and land clearances. As the planet itself has become threatened by pollution, climate change, and overexploitation, perhaps we can learn something from our more ecologically sensitive migrating ancestors. Now, these ancestors spent something of the order of 35 hours a week foraging for food. We have to spend at least 10 hours a week more in developed countries, and workers in developing countries spent double again. So maybe it wasn't quite so tough out there. It may have been somewhat easier than is easily imagined. So this is the other diagram that I wanted to show you, and it's really kind of an interesting venture. Paul Salopek is doing a 7 to 10 mile walk. We're not quite sure how long it's going to take, for the National Geographic, setting out from the Rift Valley and is basically walking to the Cape Horn. And along the way is reporting for the National Geographical magazine. But the virtue of this map is that it sort of gives us a sense for the first time, I think, both of period, those slices are, you know, different time zones, and also of the practicalities of it. So you can see somehow that it made sense that the continents did link together in some obvious sense. Now, of course, it's not the case that it was a simple movement from place A to place B. There may have been three different movements out of Africa. There was definitely a big move back as I think people hit Siberia and said, this is mighty cold, and turned back again. So it's not a simple story, and we have to spend a long time trying to uncover these as new fossil remains become manifest. Okay, so that's the first theme. Now we're jumping, you know, quite a lot of years, and we go into our second theme. And the second theme is about Irish emigration. And I thought quite hard about what to select for today's talk. And I thought this sort of makes sense because suddenly Ireland is in our minds again. We think about it in relation to Northern Ireland and Brexit. We even had, I think, a minister talk in terms of food being a potential source of leverage against the Irish in some Brexit-related discussion, quite unaware, of course, of the horrific story of the famine exodus from Ireland in 1846 to 1951, when the potato crop failed and Irish people were forced to leave Ireland, losing about 20 to 25% of the total population. It's very high in that short period of time. And this sculpture, I think, is a very, very moving sculpture. Actually, in the book, we only use one of the figures rather than this whole figure, but I like this particular one because you can see the normalcy of people walking alongside in the paths, and these very strange, haunting, Giacometti-like figures on Dublin docks, which tell this extraordinary story of people being driven to the United States, to Britain, and to Australia. But I want to use this story in another sense as well. It's a slightly odd tale. One of the theories of migration, we have many theories of migration, of course, but the ones that have been kind of disappeared off the face of scholarship is the theory developed by Marx and Engels. And they developed their theory of migration entirely from the Irish experience. Engels actually, as you probably know, inherited his father's factory in Ireland, and one of the workers was a young Irish woman, Molly, who he had an affair with. So he knew the stuff from a very intimate setting. But they developed a theory of migration, which is, I think, worth just touching on. So let me just read this passage, the second passage I'll read. The movement of Irish workers to England during the Industrial Revolution was the key historical experience informing the Marxist theory of migration, one that still generates a challenging alternative to conventional ideas. Marx started by observing that although it was widely believed that population pressed on capital, the true relationship was inverted. Capital pressed on population. The purpose was to release enough laborers to staff the emerging factories while depressing the cost of labor, but without destroying the peasant economy. That had to be sufficiently preserved to ensure that the cost of reproducing workers, covering prenatal feeding, birth, child rearing, education, and old age care, fell not to the capitalist, but to the source country or zone. Migrant workers could thus be recruited when needed and ejected while not, while simultaneously reducing the bargaining capacity of indigenous workers. Well, it's an elegant theory. and there's enough in it to be plausible, but the implied rational balancing of countervailing forces was too conspiratorial and too mechanical. In the mid-19th century, no cunning capitalist plan was able to preserve the Irish peasant economy, which was at a fragile tipping point. At nearly the same time that Marx and Engels were publishing their momentous manifesto, the potato plight struck Ireland and the Great Famine commenced. About 1.5 million Irish people left the country, mainly to North America. Okay, so that tells that story, but I want to also draw this story to your attention because it also tells of something that we've also need to know about, international solidarity, and we feel we're part of that story as well. And the Irish seem to be rather good at public monuments. This comes from Cork in the public park, and it's in the shape of a feeding bowl, but it's made up of silver feathers, eagle feathers, from the Choctaw Nation, one of the Native American peoples, who, amazingly, because they had just been displaced themselves in this phenomenon known as the Trail of Tears, raised money in support of the Irish famine victims. And this is a commemoration of that. And in fact, the chief of the Native American tribe, the Choctaws, came over to dedicate that. So it's a wonderful tale of migration and of connection between people. And this last slide is another connection, one that I think British politicians would be wise to understand, because Irish America is a very powerful force in the United States politically, and it's conventional for people with however remote a connection to visit their ancestral home in Ireland. Here you can see Reagan doing this in a coat that is clearly covering a bulletproof vest or something that doesn't quite fit. But there you go. So that's the Irish story. And I want to then turn on to my third theme, which links together two chapters, one on mass displacement and the other on the question of walls and whether walls can stop migration. So here's the first slide. And this is a slide not of migration or international migration at large, because we're talking about bigger numbers than this, but the numbers of people who have been displaced and have come to the attention in various ways of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. These are refugees, they're displaced people, they internally displaced people, they include those people in Gaza and so on. But just look at that extraordinary graph from 1951, when the United Nations Convention on Refugees was formed, and when we first developed our legal framework to integrate refugees and displaced people, and how, in a sense, the numbers have gone completely in the wrong direction. When I say the wrong direction, they seem to be growing at such a pace that their nation-state system, the migration refugee system, is unable to process them. So let me try and illustrate this with this little thing. Okay, in the time that took to swivel, one person was displaced. And in terms of the everyday integration of displacees who were settled in 2018, last year, only 1.3% were settled. So we're talking about a very big problem, okay? That on one hand, the graph of people who need settlement is going up, and on the other hand, our capacity or willingness to integrate them and settle them is going down. So another one. And what has been the response? Well, of course, there are many examples of generosity of spirit. One has to think, for example, of the of Chancellor Merkel in Germany. But the generality of the responses has been to wall off migration rather than to embrace people who are displaced or seeking settlement for other reasons. And we can now document this. So that's the wall going up, the Berlin Wall going up. Symbolically, of course, the wall, when we talk about walls. And it came down in 1989. Yes, that's right, in 1989. And at that time, there were, roughly speaking, 15 walls worldwide. Now, I use walls more metaphorically than exactly, because walls can be quite exotic. If you look at the Spanish Sahara, there is a wall that is made out of sand that has been banked up, and you say, oh, that can't be very formidable. Well, it is actually, if it's been mined, which it has been, okay? And there are fences, there are barbed wire, there are all kinds of ways of walling people off. So we use the word in a rather loose sense. 15 in 1989, 65 walls of similar sort now. So quadrupling the number of walls. So it's not just President Trump who's building walls, walls between India and Bangladesh, and there are many other examples. And I want to just show you one or two. Look at that one. Now, that isn't a break in the wall. That is a very good artist drawing a break in the wall. And it's one of the ways in which walls have, as it were, proliferated in terms of our own understanding of walls is that we proliferate the vocabulary of walls. So this one is called a separation barrier, not a wall. The Israelis insist it's not a wall. Okay. Looks quite like a wall to most people looking at the photograph. But what's interesting about this wall is you'd think, well, okay, most people would not be very keen on the idea of a wall separating one sovereign country to another. But perhaps as a result of the enormous conflicts in the area, the Green Line, which is the 67 barrier, could be walled off. Could be. So is that what this is about? No, it turns out that the Israeli separation barrier is twice the length of the Green Line. And it snakes its way to incorporate various Israeli settlements and to squeeze out various Palestinian settlements. So this is a wall that is also a statement not merely of national sovereignty, but of some kind of movement, of some claim to new land and so on. So that's a kind of interesting wall. And look at this one. This is Sirte. One of two possessions that Spain has in North Africa, in their enclaves in Morocco. And it's only about 9 miles, 14 kilometers to Cadiz, to the province of Cadiz in Spain, across the Straits of Gibraltar. And in this little Spanish enclave, that's, of course, European territory. And Africans who are standing on the top of that wall, stroke fence, occasionally break the fence down, jump over it, and are in Europe, at which point they're incarcerated in a camp in Ceuta. But some of them make it through. So this is the raw end of Fortress Europe. And there have been known raw in the sense of people approaching the fence and getting clubbed or with fists being punched back across the border. So this is about as raw and as horrible as it gets. And that's Europe, okay? And then we come on to the notorious wall, the wall that President Trump wishes to build across the Rio Grande or along the Rio Grande, which he calls his big, beautiful wall. And you may recall that during his presidential campaign, over and over again, he recited the call, build that wall, build that wall, and the supporters responded, build that wall, build that wall. He had other various fanciful ideas that Mexico would pay for the wall and so on. But this is a very interesting case because, as you can see from that diagram, there isn't no wall and then a wall or a proposed wall. There have been barriers of various sorts going up for years on end. And so it's been possible to track the effect of increased bordering or creation of borders from over time. And one very important population sociologist and demographer called Douglas Massey at Princeton has been analyzing whether walls work. And to do so, he's been trying to look at the effect of the gradual hardening of the wall. And what he's found generally is as the wall gets tougher and tougher, as more of the easy crossings get walled off, so it's become more and more expensive to cross the wall. So for that reason, one-way crossings have accelerated compared with transversal circulation. Okay. Now, bear in mind this is a common zone. It's been economically the same zone for many, many years. Hispanic America, as Mexico extended, that's why the places called Los Angeles and San Francisco and so on, all these Spanish names are indicative of the fact that Spanish America was part of, in terms of politics, law, economics, culture, and everything else. So what Massey found is as the wall gets tighter, so the one-way crossings go up. And people don't find it's, the reason being, of course, it's more expensive to hire people, it's more expensive to pay off the border crosses, and so it's not worth your while coming back for family holidays, for routines, for retirement, and so on. Because if you come back to Mexico, you'll find it very difficult and very expensive to return to the United States. So the paradox of this, as Massey points out, is the wall is actually keeping people in rather than keeping them out. And he's got lots of statistics to try and demonstrate that. So this is one interesting example. But I want to also turn to something, if you like, of a more symbolic understanding of the wall, because you know, it may be that walls don't literally work in the sense of keeping people out, or don't work very well, or don't work in all circumstances. We have to talk about all sorts of different examples. I'm not making a generalization that they never work and they don't work at all, but that they work at different levels. And one of the ways in which they work is symbolically. So I want to, in my last passage, talk about why build a wall. So this is what it reads. It would be an exaggeration to say that walls and similar barriers have no effect on inward investment or inward migration flows, but their potency is vastly exaggerated. In the USA-Mexico situation, there's a good case to be made that facilitating return through easy remittance of earnings, tax breaks, and working with the Mexican authorities to enhance returnees' investments would be more effective than barrier controls. This suggests that walls are being erected for other reasons, principally as a way of assuaging long-standing residents' angry reaction to foreigners. Trump's big, beautiful wall, as he calls it, is a visible and concrete reminder of the phrase, we here, you there. In observing a similar phenomenon in Israel, Rachel Busbridge suggests that a wall is a performance of sovereignty, a way of bombastically declaring a physical space to be ours. She explains that a wall also, quote, reflects deep power asymmetries, with its materiality holding profound discursive and effective implication for the subjectivities and psyches of the respective nations, unquote. So a wall is sending a powerful message, not only saying you can't come here, but also that we can enforce our will because we are stronger, which is precisely the message that Trump's supporters wish to hear. In short, controlling migration is far less important to populist leaders than appearing to control migration. Okay. Right, so the last slide simply is the rather extraordinary picture of a young woman that appears on the front cover or next to the frontispiece of the book. So hopefully that will entice you to buy a book. So we've got a Q&A, and I'm going to take the opportunity to pass a copy around. If you make sure it comes back to me, and I'll turn now to Ian. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Robin. That was fantastic. Three remarkable little tasters of the book, which I'm sure will entice us all to get it. I particularly liked your starting with the DNA. Incidentally, if any of you are interested in your own DNA, National Geographic and various others allow you to send off a bit of saliva, and you will see that we all come from East Africa. I did it on both my mother's and father's sides, the front and back of my book, Exceptional People, is that trace. But we're all Africans, and that was a very good starting point, not least for two South Africans. great, we have about 25 minutes. Who would like to pose the first question? We are being live streamed and webcast and videoed, so if you don't want to be recorded, I suggest you don't ask a question. Clara's in the back. Let's take the person over there.
First of all, very fascinating talk. Thank you very much. One of your slides that was looking at the numbers and the increase of displacement saw quite a significant spike around 1972, 1973, which seemed to kind of precede the trend in growth. And I was just wondering what had happened around that period that might have contributed towards that spike, and did that influence the growth in numbers over subsequent years?
I think you might have floored me. I'm looking.
Does anyone have the answer?
I'm looking at my friend Jeff and Oliver.
Robin, yes. I think it's the expulsion from Uganda
and East
Africa. Oh, yeah. Yes, that would have accounted for some, but not those. Not quite those numbers.
I think it may be the expulsions from East Africa, and in particular from Uganda, that created a spike, because it was in the hundreds of thousands, ultimately. Mm. So I may be wrong, but I think that was it, because the Vietnamese boat people came later.
I'm sure that's part of it, and that of course, is a crucial element there. I suspect, I'm just sort of thinking on the trot here, that this was a period when legitimate migration was squeezed rather dramatically in Europe. I mean, I'm sure your Ugandans are part of the story, but they're relatively small numbers involved, given that we're talking about millions here. And I suspect this may be that the displaced people, this is a different gate, as it were, because they couldn't come in as legitimate refugees, because there was a big, as you remember, the recession of following the oil price hikes of the early 70s led to quite a strong squeeze on legitimate migration into Europe. So that may also be part of it. But thank you very much. That's a good contribution.
Yeah. I was working on it at the time.
Yeah.
Good, okay, so the mic's in the front now, and we'll move backwards. Yeah.
Thank you. Using biological terms, at what point in history did the Negroid population turn into the three races of Negroid, Caucasoid, and Mongoloid?
Yeah. Okay, so these expressions, of course, are somewhat out of date. People don't tend to use them quite so often. But I want to address your point quite directly by pointing to something that I think was a bit of a surprise for most of us, which was a fossil discovery in the Cheddar Gorge in the UK, in which reconstructed produced somebody who had a dark skin for at least 30,000 years longer than people had anticipated. So this is a little peculiar because obviously the lighter skin is better adapted to climates where you would have lower sun and you need vitamin D for your health. So the assumption was that adaptive response had come quite a lot earlier. So it seems as if darker-skinned people were in Europe much later than had normally been assumed. Now, obviously, people look different, and the evolutionary story is partly that is best expressed in terms of a tree. Okay, if you imagine the branches of the trees splaying out to the different continents, the continents then drifting apart, or access becoming much more difficult because of the Ice Age or various other phenomena, then you begin to get certain genetic characteristics and clusters taking place. And I suppose one would want to date those at different points, but this is what's, in a sense, kind of surprising me, because you suddenly find, oh, here's a discovery of somebody in Indonesia or in Sumatra who looks somewhat like somebody in Polynesia or Madagascar. So it's not quite so obvious as splitting into three, but certainly that splitting phenomena in terms of physical appearance did occur through adaptive response, genetic drift, and a degree of clustering, of genetic clustering. Ian, you may want to add something on that.
No, I think you said it admirably.
I wondered if you, in your research for your book and the book itself, looked at the very important historical walls, like Hadrian's Wall and the Great Wall of China, and the short and long-term effects of those.
Yeah. When I say looked at, I was aware of that when I was doing that chapter on walls and thought quite hard about whether that, you know, there were analogies that could be drawn from that. And of course, there's no doubt that they did mark off civilizational outposts. So Hadrian's Wall was really saying the Roman Empire kind of ends here. I'm less convinced that it was really an effective barrier. Haven't walked Hadrian's Wall, but I've seen pictures of and talked to people who've walked it. And it actually isn't that formidable an obstacle. So one does wonder whether it was much more like the Trumpian symbolic wall, that it was a way of saying, here we are, there you are. And I think that's probably untrue of the Great Wall of China, which did seem to be a pretty serious affair with, you know, soldiers patrolling it and the definite attempt to keep out alien invaders. So I think the answer is the study of walls is really interesting because they work at different levels, practical and symbolic. And that, I suppose, was the kind of argument I was trying to make.
In the first part of your book, you emphasized all the disadvantages of sedentary
life. Yeah. Okay, you faded off a little bit, but I think you were saying, what about the advantages of the sedentary life? Yeah, well, of course, you know, in a way, I was trying to contradict a conventional wisdom. So virtually every sort of undergraduate or school textbook would talk in terms of settled agriculture, civilization of Mesopotamia, of Egypt, praising the sedentary and as, if you like, the form of civilization that is sort of obvious, that is teleological. That's where human beings were destined to be. And I think this new take on it basically arises from the post-Gaia world, where we are understanding the Earth as a much more fragile object. So civilizations tramping through the jungles and putting up great Mayan pyramids are not really what it's all about. What it's all about now is stewardship, of trying to ensure that this fragile planet is not further trampled or further disadvantaged. So I think perhaps one might want to say there is a golden age of sedentary civilizations which may be coming to an end. This sounds very apocalyptic. I don't mean to sound like a prophet or something like that. But we're beginning to understand that there are serious disadvantages. When we put up skyscrapers and millions of birds smash into them, and that isn't such great news. When we have floods that arise from the fact that we've just soaked away all our wetlands to have settled agriculture, that's not such great news. And of course, we can carry on that argument. And the two authors that I quote are Harari. People will know his book *Sapiens*. You know, it's a book that's often bought and perhaps less often read. But he does make this point about the relative hours that we spend making our livelihood compared with early foragers. And another important book by Sussman I think it's called Primitive Affluence, where he suggests actually these folk were living in pretty good lifespans, they were in good health, they had a sort of harmonic relationship with nature, and of course they lasted for 200,000 years. And there are not that many empires, in fact there are none, that lasted for 200,000 years. So I think one does need to sort of rethink our conventional narrative of human history and maybe say, well, maybe we're not doing it completely right.
Actually, I'll be backtracking a little bit. I wanted to add on to the discussion about the Great Wall of China, and I was thinking that's actually an interesting idea about the potential ambivalence of walls, because while at certain points in Chinese history, walls were to keep people, like there was a northern group of people called the Xiongnu, out of China because they were raiding, at other points, that there were actually political negotiation, trade, interaction, marriages with the Chinese state to kind of keep the border pacified. And then we have at other points the empire going beyond the walls to conquer people and to expand its territory. So I just thought it may be really interesting to think about how walls can mark a boundary, but maybe the kind of interaction that is happening is not necessarily one of separation, but it actually underscores a specific kind of interaction, and that sort of interaction can change with time. And that I thought may be interesting when we think about the wall between Mexico and the United States, because that actually the true picture is of actually two countries that are economically, socially, and culturally intertwined in many ways. So yeah, I just wanted to add to that.
Okay, thanks very much. I'm not going to respond because you clearly know a hell of a lot more than I do. So thank you very much for that contribution.
Yeah, thanks very much, Robin. As you know, there are dozens of articles which start off with the observation that international migration is now much larger in numbers, more widespread in geographical scale, and more complex in nature than at any other time in human history. Is that actually true?
Okay. Jeff, thanks very much. This is one that, you know, us migration scholars wrestle with all the time, because on the one hand, we want to make sure that we don't overestimate the crisis logic. Oh, it's so bad, there are more migrants, and they're terrible. And then, of course, the comparison point is important. And I suppose the easiest comparison, which many people do use as the comparison point, is with the United States, and in particular with transatlantic migration. So without going into the full international complexities, let's just deal with that Atlantic migration, which happens essentially after the movement from sail to steam, 1882 roughly, and then you begin to get a huge migration across the Atlantic to the point where, and it ends rather abruptly in 1914 with the outbreak of the First World War, because the merchant navy is then appropriated for war purposes, or it is feared that people migrating will be sunk by German submarines, as there were some examples of that, you may be aware. So you've got this nice little period, 1882, 1914. At that point, the level of migration relative to the local population was higher than the current level of migration. So, however, it was roughly foreign-born to local, at its height was roughly about 16%, I think, and now it's creeping up to about 13%. So it's certainly high by historic standards, but not the highest it's ever been, particularly, of course, that migration flows are often determined by how keen not only the people are who are migrating, but how keen they are you are to have migrants. And at the turn of the 1920th century, for many people, having a large population was an important way of affirming your national power. It was a way of expanding your industrial base. In the United States, there is no doubt that a push in industrialization was driven by large-scale immigration. And you can see it in the first instance from people being displaced off the land, the so-called Great Migration from the South to the North, that's to say black Americans, but also transatlantic migrants who were used in the emerging factories. And those of you who want to study a marvelously racist tract, you can have a look at Henry Ford's biography or autobiography, where he describes how he wishes to use these different formations of immigrants for different purposes. So one group would be good on screws, the others would be good on nuts, and as for those dumb pollocks, his words, they would be good in cleaning up, you know, that kind of thing. So he was quite aware of the need for immigrant labor. So I don't know, that obviously doesn't answer the question entirely, because you'd have to take different slices, different periods, different things. So it's a matter of measured response. It's not enormous by historic standards, but it is important now.
Yeah, good to see you, Jeff. I've done some recent work on this, and I think that there's just some headlines. It's about 3.4% of the world's population now. It's been much higher in the late 19th century. It's been in this new normal for about the last 35 years. That's particularly if you don't include refugees, and a big part of that's where the big growth has been, refugees. Of course, the absolute number's much bigger. The other important point to bear in mind is that there's 100 new countries. And by definition, if migrants or people that cross borders create 100 new countries, you would expect, actually, the numbers to be much higher than they were crossing the same space, like the Soviet Union disintegrating into 15 countries, for example. So if you discount that, it's actually lower. And, of course, the other point is that we now count migrants.
There were no passports until the First World War for most countries and most places. And so what we understand about migration is fundamentally different, and this, the counting might also be contributing to growing awareness.
I mean, that's a terribly helpful intervention, thanks. And in fact, those of you who haven't seen it, there's a very good paper by Ian with, I think, the Citibank Commission on the Oxford Martin School website, which goes through some of these data in considerable detail, and some very nice graphs as well.
Hello, I really enjoyed the talk. Just as one point, I suspect that the spike in the early 70s may have been the then civil war between Pakistan and Bangladesh, which displaced, at that time, untold numbers of people. And my second question, or my other point rather, is I just wanted to pick up on something Professor Golden mentioned, which is perhaps the difference between being forcibly displaced and voluntary migration. I was wondering if you could give us... forcibly displaced people and people who have migrated voluntarily you know, it's very difficult to judge what economic circumstances are forcible and which are not. But if you could give us some sense of scale, that would be very helpful to understand the context here. Thank you.
Okay, now this is the big hot potato, and you know, we even have it institutionally hardwired into Oxford, where we have a migration center and we have a refugee study center, and we have this debate endlessly about differences between the two, those people who are compelled and those people who are free to migrate. And of course, the great problem with this is that you spend a lot of time on the definition. I want to just make one or two fairly obvious points. If you look on the refugee side, quite a high proportion, an increasing proportion of people who are refugees, deemed refugees, or are seen as refugees by others or self-proclaim themselves as refugees, are coming with children and with people accompanying them. So it's not 1951 when you have people who are self-declared refugees who might have a political opinion that differed from their country of origin, and who therefore and therefore are getting recognition in the legal system. You're having mass movement. And so it's very difficult to say this person is a refugee and that person is not. How do you classify a child, for example, in those circumstances? Do they simply take on the definition of their parent, and which parent? So it gets complicated on the other side as well, because of course people are pushed by all sorts of forces, some of which are not formally registered in the legal framework which recognizes refugees. Now, the most obvious, of course, is economic factors, but also there are such things as, you know, gender discrimination or sex discrimination. There are people moving for all kinds of compelling reasons other than simply seeking a new life abroad. So the short answer is it's very difficult to get a kind of take on this question, but I'm going to do a big sort of Ian Golden venture into big numbers, and you must correct me if I'm wrong. I think roughly on the defined migrant side, about 270 million, and on the defined displaced side, 70 million. But just be careful about those numbers, because definitions are incredibly important in understanding how we place people into one category or the other. I'm more or less.
I think
right
we've got time. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think it might be the last.
Just two quick questions. Just wondering what you think or thought about the late Barbara Harrison's work regarding refugees in Oxford. My second question will be, what do you think about global displacement because of climate change or forced migration?
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much, because that's very important. And, you know, of course, displacement is not recognized in the 51 Convention, so it's partly an answer to the previous intervention as well, to say thank you for that intervention. There is a separate chapter in the book on climate-induced migration, And obviously, it's incredibly important. The broad generalization I would make is that we tend, because it's telegenic, to focus on rising sea levels. And of course, there are some dramatic examples of countries that are about to disappear, or in one or two small cases have disappeared. And so we imagine that what is happening is the rising sea creates mass displacement, and that then results in international displacement, and then you get quite a lot of alarmist discussion about this. The much more plausible argument to make is that sea levels are rising, they're rising relatively slowly, and people have to back off the sea into higher land. And so there is some element of adjustment. However, if you look at the big numbers on climate-displaced migration, you often find places where arable lands are no longer possible and where people cannot actually engage in settled agriculture anymore. So they become rootless, they move into that category of people seeking a new life. So yes, it's very important numerically, but don't be dazzled by the coastal story, or don't confine the argument to the coastal story. There's also a very important story about arable agriculture.
Great, I think that's all we've got time for. There's over 40 chapters in the book, and I encourage you to look at this incredible array of arguments, images, and data that Robin's assembled. He's only got 40 copies of his book at £10 available, so the first 40 will get them. The rest of you are going to have to buy it at £20 at Blackwell's or elsewhere. And I encourage you to buy it. At the Oxford Martin School, you not only get incredible free intellectual food, but you also get a drink after something like this. And so I invite you all to the reception, which will be out the door and next door, and then you can carry on your conversation with each other and with Robin as well. Thanks to you all for coming. It's been a dark, cold night, and thanks to Robin.